Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and life coach David Bartke here.
It is Thursday, August the 10th, 2017. We are on the last chapter of The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, chapter 10. This is our episode 10 of our exploration of that rather groundbreaking book. And David, it's been really fun so far. I'm hoping the last chapter is just as good as the first nine. What do you think?
I know, it's been amazing. Well, I'm sure it will be. And I'm looking forward to hearing what it's about.
Well, then let's just jump right in. This actually has a very nice chapter title. It kind of summarizes everything as a final chapter should do. It's called The Secret to Life.
Oh, I like that.
And it starts with a quote from Neil Donald Walsh. It says, "There is no blackboard in the sky on which God has written your purpose or your mission in life. There's no blackboard in the sky that says, Neil Donald Walsh, a handsome guy who lived in the first part of the 21st century, who," and then there's a blank, and all he has to do is to really understand what he's doing here, why he's here, is to fill that, find that blackboard and find out what God really has in mind by filling in that blank. But the blackboard doesn't exist. Well, if the blackboard doesn't exist, that means your purpose is what you say it is. Your mission is the mission you give to yourself. Your life will be what you create it as, and no one will stand in judgment of it now or ever. You get to fill in the blackboard of your life. That's really quite a different message from what you hear from almost any other religious or metaphysical or spiritual speaker.
Yeah. In fact, but I love it, Doug, because I like that, you know, we get to choose to do that.
We do get to choose, and it is probably the most positive message I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, because where's the negative in getting to choose? That's about the best you get, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, Jack Canfield gets quoted next. He says, it took a lot of years for him to get this point. He says, because I grew up very much with this idea that there was something I was supposed to do, and if I wasn't doing it, God wouldn't be happy with me. When I really understood that my primary aim was to feel and experience joy, then I began to do only those things which brought me joy. I have a saying, he says, if it ain't fun, don't do it.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, a lot of people would probably think, how dare you only do things that make you feel joyful? Who do you think you are?
Yeah, well, sure. When you live in a fear-based environment, that's going to be the first thought that's going to come to most people's heads.
That's right. But it's wonderful to know that we can do that.
Yeah, I mean, what a mind-opening experience and idea that we actually can choose to be happy. We don't have to be miserable. Miserable is not noble.
That's right.
Wow.
How dare you be happy?
Yeah, how dare you, right? What's wrong with you anyway? Get with the program. And then Neil Donald Walsh jumps in again. He says, joy, love, freedom, happiness, laughter, that's what it is. And if you just experience joy sitting there and meditating for an hour, by golly, do that. And if you experience joy eating a salami sandwich, then do that. Jack Canfield says, when I pet my cat, I'm in a state of joy. Actually, I am too, in part because my cat's name is Joy.
Oh, funny. That's cheating. Wait a minute. You're cheating, Walt.
Oh, no, it's not cheating at all. In fact, it was deliberate.
I'm only kidding.
We named, and believe it or not, it's a him. We originally thought he was a she and named her Joy. Joy and Harmony are the two cats we have, and they were both rescues. Rescues, they were abandoned by the people who lived across the street. And so we kind of adopted them. We think they'd been on their own living wild for about a month. And we adopted them. She was really thin. And he, who we thought originally was she, was the more aggressive one, willing to come up and say, hey, take care of us. We're good cats.
Wow. What color are they?
They're both jet black.
Nice.
But we ended up taking them to the ASPCA in order to get them, to the local shelter to get them fixed, and found they'd already been fixed. And, oh, by the way, Joy is a she. Joy, we thought he was a she. He's actually a he. oops. But he also is the friendliest, happiest, most joyful cat I've ever met.
Oh, so
we had to keep the name Joy, even though it's generally regarded as a female name. It fits him to a T. So he is Joy.
Well, in the cat world, it's just fine.
In the cat world, it's perfect.
Yes.
In fact, we call him the neighborhood ambassador. We live currently in an apartment complex, and literally he's the one who introduces himself first to everyone in the complex. Everybody knows who he is.
Oh, my goodness.
We have little kids that come up and say, can Joy come out to play?
Oh.
I'm not kidding. Really. That really happens.
And do you send him out to play?
Actually, he's always out. He doesn't like coming in.
Oh, well, see, he's out there spreading joy.
That's right. That's what he does.
Yes.
But getting back to the point here, the idea is petting a cat can actually help you achieve a state of joy. It's a great
Definitely.
Way to counter feeling negative about stuff. So if you're
mm-hmm.
If you're stuck on something, you find you're just caught in one of those negative loops. Well, petting Joy is a great way to get out of it, because first of all, this particular cat especially, you can't pet him without getting loads of attention and affection out of it. Can't be done.
Then the more the better.
And that's why it doesn't really matter what kind of pet you have either. I mean, if you're a dog lover, works great with dogs.
Yeah. No, we have two dogs, and I always feel very happy when I'm playing with them and petting them and giving them attention. It's so nice.
In fact, I can't remember who it was who said this the first time that I saw it. I know numerous people have said it. But dogs have a really amazing, wonderful capacity to love you all the time, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, it's true. What's the word that they use to describe it?
Unconditional.
Unconditional, yeah. It's true unconditional love.
Yes, that is true from my experience, yep.
And it doesn't matter what kind of day you had. They feel exactly the same way about you every single time. Doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So having a dog is a wonderful way to help get yourself into that state of joy that they're talking about.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So what are your favorite ways to achieve a state of joy?
Well, one is, like I just said, I love playing with my dogs, taking them out for walks, brushing them, petting them. That's a very good way. I always think doing something fun does that for me as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like everyone has different things that they like doing, but doing something fun for sure puts me in a nice state of joy. And sometimes in meditation, just from being in that calm space, everything just feels right, and it just puts me in that nice frame of mind, a nice vibration.
Now, there are some people who say that you have to distinguish between feeling joy and feeling contentment. And that, mm-hmm. and that feeling contentment is the most that you can ever hope for. I have never really bought into that, but what do you think of that debate? Have you heard that one before?
No, I agree with you. No, I think you can feel content and you can feel joy. I mean,
I don't think it's really, you have to pick one or the other. I think you can feel joy all the time if you really want to. You have to work mm-hmm. at it perhaps at first, but
mm-hmm.
there's no reason we can't feel joy every moment of the day.
Absolutely.
The only reason we don't is because we're so habitually caught up in the pattern of thinking about negatives and feeling miserable about certain things and so forth.
Right, and of all the media and all that kind of thing.
Oh, the media, the news, the politics, you name
yeah.
it. There's a lot of opportunities to feel negative in this world.
Yes, there are. Just what are you choosing,
Yeah, so the fact that we can decide what we're going to focus on is pretty powerful stuff.
Yes, actually, I was going to bring up something that Esther Hicks said, and just because you said that is triggering me to think of it.
Okay.
And she was talking about, obviously, law of attraction and what we're attracting, and she said, we're never saying no to something.
True.
Ever.
Yeah.
Because what we're focusing on, we're saying yes to.
That's really a critical point.
And if you can really get that, that's huge.
Yeah.
We're never saying no to anything. We're always saying yes. Like it's up to us to decide what we're saying yes to.
And it's a point where I have to take issue with some Christians. There are some mm-hmm. Christians who say God answers all prayers, but sometimes the answer is no. And that's not true. The answer is always yes. The question mm-hmm. is, what did you pray for?
Yes. Yes.
Because we tend to think, well, I prayed for something, fill in the blank, something great. But if you follow that up with another 15 minutes of thinking about the opposite or something really negative, guess what? You just contradicted your own prayer. You know, if you pray for health and then you spend the next half hour worrying about having cancer, that doesn't help.
No, and or anything else that we're focusing on. Whenever we say no, I don't want yada 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 to happen, then you're saying yes to it happening.
That's right.
Because you're focusing on it.
Because literally, the answer to every prayer is yes.
Yeah. So that sentence she said kind of really, like, all my alarms were going off, like, oh, my God, I have to always remember that.
Yeah.
Always remember that.
I have to say it was really frightening the first time that I realized how serious you had to be about – serious is perhaps the wrong word – how dedicated you have to be to focusing deliberately on what you want and taking your mind off what you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's right. It's so easy to fall into that trap.
It is, because in conversation, that's what people do a lot. So we just kind of adopt that growing up, and we think that's the way to do it.
And not just in conversation. When we talk to ourselves, we do it.
Yeah, then we have ourselves talk about it.
Yeah. If there's one thing worse than having somebody else talk negatives to you, it's the self-talk that tells negatives to yourself.
Yeah, a lot of people do that about their jobs. They're so focused on what they don't like about their job,
mm-hmm.
and they just keep attracting not liking their job, liking their job.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no limit to the different realms in which we apply this negative approach. We're very skilled at it.
So if we could always remember, we're never saying no to anything. It really kind of helps us realize we better be very careful what we're thinking about.
Another quote that comes out in The Secret comes from Joseph Campbell, who, interestingly enough, wrote quite a bit from a Christian perspective. And I can't say I ever investigated Campbell on this whole question of God in answering prayers. I'm not 100% sure what he said, but I do know he said this: follow your bliss and the universe will open doors for you where there were only walls. So I kind of suspect he buys into the same idea that there's no such thing as saying no to a prayer.
I would think so.
I would think so, too. I mean, it wouldn't make much sense otherwise. Because follow your bliss, I mean, that's pretty straightforward.
What do you take that as meaning? I mean, it sounds good, but what do you take that as meaning?
Follow what makes you happy, what makes you joyful.
Mm-hmm. In terms of everything, or just career-wise, or what?
Everything.
Yeah.
No limit.
Yeah.
It's not like it's only going to work with career.
Yeah.
Which is actually reassuring. It works everywhere. You know, it's a universal rule. It's a law. Law of attraction is a law, and it always applies.
Yes, it is.
And this is an extension of the law of attraction, the idea if you follow what you love the most. That's another thing that when we first see something like The Secret or read a book like it or you know, any of the past books from the uh-huh. past couple hundred years that touched on the same subject in various ways, we tend to think, okay, I have to think very specifically about what it is that I want and focus on that. And in fact, there are some teachers who actually teach that. They teach you, you know, get very clearly in your mind that what you want and stay focused on that and don't let yourself deviate from that one thing.
Uh-huh.
But you mentioned Esther Hicks, Abraham Hicks. They, among others, Mike Dooley teaches this too. They suggest being more general about it. In other words, go for what feels good. Just do anything that it's required to feel good and that will take you into a good feeling place. And just focus on wanting to feel good all the time and putting all your energy into just wanting to feel good all the time. And when you do that, all kinds of stuff starts coming to you, including stuff that you asked about, you know, a long time ago that was just kind of stuck out there in the universe. It wasn't coming. It wasn't going. It was just kind of stuck there. You know, so the idea is make it general and make it, you know, what's the overall final positive results you are looking for rather than thinking about particular things that you're trying to attract. And you actually end up attracting a lot more. That's the point.
Yeah, and I love that because it reminds us that pretty much the reason why we want to attract things we want to attract is because it's going to make us feel good.
Yeah.
So if we deliberately keep ourselves in the vibration of feeling good, then we can't help but attract circumstances and experiences that support us feeling good.
Have you read Sean Aker's book, The Happiness Advantage?
I have not. No.
I highly recommend it because Sean is an advocate of the law of attraction. He's not.
Right.
But he is a positive psychology advocate. And the whole point of his book is to hammer home the point that if you want to be happy in life, you can't work towards success and expect the success to make you happy. You actually have to be happy before the success will come.
That's very law of attraction. I love that.
Very law of attraction. Yeah. He doesn't see it that way, but hey, I don't care. It works anyway. It reinforces the whole idea that if you feel the joy, if you feel the happiness, the other stuff comes.
That's right. That's right.
Well, it's not just
attracted to you.
Now this is no longer just metaphysical, because his conclusions were based on actual scientific studies that proved that people who were happy first ended up having better results in their life second.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to verify this, first of all, with some interesting longitudinal studies.
Right.
One of the more famous ones called the Nuns Study. Have you ever heard of that one?
I have not heard of that.
Apparently back around, I'm going to guess, 1930-ish, something like that, the Catholic Church had a sister who was like the head of the novitiates and head of the nuns and so forth across the country. And she sent out a letter to all of the churches and all the different parishes and so forth, where there was some sort of sizable population of nuns, and asked them to write out basically sort of a 2 or 3 page potted biography or autobiography, if you will. And it wasn't so much an autobiography. It was more about talking about what they hoped to achieve as nuns as they progressed through their lives. And she especially ordered that it be done with novitiates, with women who are just now becoming nuns at that time and at that period of time. And as they became nuns, one of the first things they did was to write out this paper. And the church did a fairly good job of collecting them. A lot of them got lost over the years, but literally hundreds of them were preserved. And so Sean Aker reports how the researchers who discovered this cache of really valuable information got permission from the church to go through all of these little autobiographies that these nuns wrote, that these novitiates wrote, and they were able to correlate them with the actual persons and with how old they were when they entered the novitiate condition and all that kind of thing. And then they followed them through their lives because, of course, this was all in the past. There was no setup here. There was no it wasn't like the researchers were in some way poisoning the waters, because it all had already happened without their intending anything. So all they really had to do was just read the record.
Mm-hmm.
And they found a number of very interesting things. One thing they did is they divided – they had people just read the letters and based on their own judgment – evaluate 5 different categories. Put each letter into one of 5 categories. So category 1 would be, this is a really happy person. Category 2 would be, this is the second highest of happy. Category 5 would be, this is a very unhappy person. So basically a 5-point scale of happiness to unhappiness. And then they correlated those results with what these independent, unbiased readers rated the various letters and autobiographies, and they basically just counted them up and figured out how many were in each category and so forth. And then they compared it to the longevity, because by that time, a lot of them had died. A lot of them had their full lifetimes, And they found that the nuns who entered the novitiate status with a happy mindset were likely to live 20 years longer than the ones who came in with the most unhappy mindset. Based on what actually happened. And it's not like the nuns said, well, I'm going to be happy so I can live an extra 20 years. That was the furthest thing from their minds. So this is a very, very good study, because it showed that, very clearly your predisposed mindset directly impacts your future life. So,
I believe that.
If anybody ever wanted to have scientific proof that the law of attraction works, there is some really good scientific proof.
Because you do, I know from my own experience and from what my clients tell me, once you do keep yourself deliberately at a raised vibration for a while, you definitely feel better overall.
Like, yes.
Even your health, you just feel just healthier and good and it just makes a big difference.
And that's something else that the researchers wanted to make clear when they made their report. It's not like if you start off with an unhappy mindset, you're locked in for life. Because you can actually change your mind about how you're going to feel about things and thereby influence your life and the final results.
Good point. That's true.
Yeah. It's not like you're locked in. And you're not locked in at the high place either. I mean, it is possible for you to focus on negativity for the rest of your life and, you know, basically produce negative results. What they were trying to do was take advantage of some really useful data just to see what happens over a lifetime when people just go by default without knowing one way or another, you know, how important or unimportant it is to focus on positive or negative, just to see what happened. And that's what they were able to find, that there were tremendous differences between the people who went in to the whole thing from the beginning with a positive mindset and those who went in with a very negative mindset.
Yeah. It's very interesting study, and it's true, and I totally can see how that would be.
There are also other studies that have been done. This isn't the only one. A lot of studies have been based on historical records, like the Nunn study. Some of them were more contrived studies. One of the more famous ones that Ager reports on is a study that was conducted 1978, 1979, something like that, by Dr. Ellen Langer, who is a professor of positive psychology at Harvard University, where Sean went to school. And in this study, she brought together two groups of older men, men in their 60s and 70s and even early 80s, and divided them into two groups. One group was her control group, so she basically asked them to just stay in the same place for a week. The other group, she asked them to stay in the same place for a week, but she also put up pictures and mementos and so forth from the 1950s, when, you know, 20 years previous, and gave them all name badges that had their picture from when they were 20 years younger, and asked them to act for the next week like it was 1950s instead of the 1970s. And of course, before the study began, for both the control group and the test group, she took all kinds of physical measurements, everything that you could possibly think of to measure, she measured. And then after the week was up, she did the same thing again, measured all, you know, took all the physical measurements that she could take. And the results were astonishing. On average, the visible physical age, you know, based on what a neutral observer would say, okay, this is how old that person looks. The visible age of the people in the test group was 3 years younger on average than when it had begun.
Wow.
This was after 1 week.
Just by strictly doing that.
Just by doing that. And that wasn't the only result. There were a lot of results that were extremely positive. The one that impressed me the most, their eyesight improved by 10%.
How is that possible?
That's what they were wondering. Their eyesight improved by 10%.
Wow.
I mean, if you have any doubt at all about how powerful this stuff is of focusing on feeling good, boy, there's some evidence for you. You can actually improve your eyesight by making yourself, convincing yourself that you're 20 years younger.
Yes, yes.
And, I mean, and that was after just 1 week. Imagine if they'd done it for a year.
Oh, my God. They would have gone back. They would have looked like they were teenagers again.
Yeah, conceivably. I mean, maybe it's a bit of an exaggeration, but... actually made that, since I first heard about that study, I've made that part of my to-do list, if you will. I have decided that I want to focus as much as I can remember to focus on pretending that I'm younger than I am. And I can't say I do it consistently. I try to, but, you know, life gets in the way. So, you know, very often I don't stick to the program. But nevertheless, there are times when I do try to stick to that program. And I can honestly say that looking at my own face in the mirror, which I usually don't like to do anyway. I don't think most of us like to look in the mirror. But when I do look in the mirror, I'm seeing a lot less wrinkled lines. I'm seeing a lot less stress lines than I saw before. I'm seeing a younger face.
It's not from a new eye cream you're using?
No, I don't use anything like that. No. I don't use any kind of cosmetic, you know, type stuff or anything. And in fact, interesting you should mention that. One of my goals is to get to the point where my hair, which is now nearly white, reverts back to its dark brown color. If I can do that, man, I will have accomplished something, I think.
Well, that'll be interesting. Let's hope it happens.
And I'm not talking with hair coloring either.
Yeah, you can use that sudden gray stuff where every week it gets a little
darker. Not doing anything like that. Not at all. Because that wouldn't be anywhere near as much fun and near as cool. I mean, if I could actually do it just purely on feeling good, what a breakthrough that is.
Yes.
You know?
What I like to tell myself and my clients is that, look, none of us know how much longer we're going to be here. We could have a day, we could have a year, we could have 20 years, but I want to go through, whether it's a day or 20 years, I want to go through as much of that time feeling good and feeling excited about life.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Whether I have a day or 100 years, like that's what I would prefer going through it like.
Yeah, Joel used to say, we can't control yesterday and tomorrow isn't promised, so focus on being joyful today.
Yes. That's right. It's kind of, if you kind of remember that, like, oh yeah, like, we don't know how much time we're going to be here, so I might as well just enjoy it while I'm here.
Although, like, interestingly enough, Abraham Hicks actually kind of hints about that too.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it in great detail, at least not of anything that I've read so far, and I can't say I've read all of their materials, but they do suggest that when people die, they die by their own choice. They decide that they're done here.
But there's no more wanting or no more desire for life,
which
kind of thing.
Actually leaves an interesting thought on the table, which is, could we also decide we want to stay?
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect the answer to that is yes. Now, are we actually going to do that? I imagine probably everybody listening to the show will probably choose to go at some point. And this is where I have kind of a weird theory here. You tell me if you think I'm off base. I believe that aging, the aging process, and particularly becoming an old person and so forth, I believe that that is a manifestation of mental illness. And by mental illness, I mean it is a manifestation of focusing on stuff that stresses us out, that makes us feel negative, that makes us feel bad. And when you do that often enough, it basically has a deleterious effect on your body. And there is some science behind my theory. I can't say that my theory has been, you know, tested and proven, not that I know of, it hasn't.
Right.
But there is a little bit of science, which is that when you're feeling good versus when you're feeling bad, your body sends out certain neurotransmitters. If you're feeling good, if you're feeling bad, or if you're feeling frightened or whatever, that's where you, things like what's the famous neurotransmitter that everybody talks about, you know, in terms of an animal needs to run quickly. Adrenaline. Adrenaline.
Yes, yes.
Well, adrenaline is basically a fight or flight neurotransmitter, and its purpose is immediately survival. But if you are exposed to it for a long period of time, it actually has deleterious. It has negative effects on the body. So if you're constantly in a fight or flight mode, you're actually shortening.
Oh, that would not be good.
Yeah, you're shortening your lifestyle, your lifespan, because basically the body. This is what the researchers found. The body, when it's constantly sending out adrenaline or cortisol or one of the other what we'll call negative neurotransmitters, they're negative in the sense that you don't want them, you know, working on you for a long period of time. They actually send out signals to cells in the body to start self-destructing. Whereas if you're feeling good, the neurotransmitters that go out are like serotonin and dopamine and the feel-good neurotransmitters. And those actually send out exactly diametrically the opposite signal, which is heal, get better.
Interesting.
So I don't think my theory is all that far off base. I think actually my theory may be true, that old age is really the manifestation of a mental illness, and that mental illness is focusing too much on negativity.
And sometimes I wonder too, like, because from birth, we're always raised like, oh, well, when you hit this age, this is going to happen. When you hit that age, that's going to happen. Like, we kind of grow up with these ideas implanted in our minds that how we age, so that we manifest that.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I was probably 9, 10, 11 years old, the seeing the people in my family who were in their 60s.
Right.
Boy, did they seem old. Let me tell you, they seemed old in every way. Well, I'm 60 now, David. I turned 60 this year. And I tell you what, I don't feel anything like what I remember those relatives behaving.
No.
I have much more energy. I feel better in so many different ways. I'm more active. I'm more alive than I can remember them ever being. I mean, literally, all I remember about them was them sitting in their easy chairs.
Wow.
That's it.
At 60?
At 60. Wow. Yeah, in their 60s. Yeah. It was amazing. And I think it's just one more piece of evidence that we become what we focus on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When people reach end of life, I think that there may be some exceptions to this, but for the most part, I think if you look at people when they're at the end of their life, they're really in suffering mode.
Seems like it.
You know, there's been so much negativity going on, and I think you get to the point where your body starts to shut down and you start to give up.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you're going to pass on. So anyway, that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it for now.
Okay.
Dr. John Hagelin, drawing back from the book, says, I see a future of unbounded potential, unbounded possibilities. He says, remember, we're using at most 5% of the potential of the human mind. 100% human potential is the result of proper education. So imagine a world where people are using their full mental and emotional potential. We could go anywhere. We could do anything. We could achieve anything. And
that sounds good.
That ties into something we've heard many times, which the idea that we're only using a small percentage of our mental faculties and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's based in large part on studies that have been done on the brain. I think actually we have to rethink that theory now. And I'll tell you why.
In what way?
There is research in the last 20 to 30 years or so that suggests that the brain is not the locus of thought.
Mm-hmm.
That thought and that the expression of intention and so forth actually happens in a broader energy field around us. And that the brain is simply an organ where it does play a key role connecting the body to this mental process, but it is not the sole origin of that process.
Mm.
Which means that if we're looking at we'll call it a brain for lack of a better term. It's an energy field, the way I understand it. If we're talking about an energy field, then the 5% limitation on the brain, that is now a small percentage of the overall energy brain, if you will.
Right.
So it isn't like we've only used 5% of our potential. We've used like 0.00005% of our potential or some ridiculous number like that, which means the amount of room to grow, it isn't just growing 20 times over that we could potentially do. It's potentially hundreds, thousands of times more.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's like anything else in life. You can choose to focus on something positively or you can choose to focus on something negatively. So how are you going to choose to look at it? But the way I see it, I like the first part of what he said. I see a future of unbounded potential and unbounded possibilities.
Absolutely.
And that's
yes.
the part that I think is accurate. I think the part really hits the nail on the head. Now, Lisa Nichols comes in and she says, she basically gives you a little bit of a view of her own psychology and followed by Michael Bernard Beckwith. So let's read what they're saying here.
Okay.
Lisa Nichols says, you've come to this juncture in your life merely because something in you kept saying you deserve to be happy. You were born to add something, to add value to this world, to simply be something bigger and better than you were yesterday. Every single thing you've been through, every single moment that you've come through, were to all prepare you for this moment right now. And imagine what you can do from this day forward with what you now know. Now you get that you are the creator of your destiny. So how much more do you get to do? How much more do you get to be? How many more people do you get to bless simply by your mere existence? What will you do with the moment? How will you seize the moment? No one else can dance your dance. No one else can sing your song. No one else can write your story. Who are you? What do you do? Whoever that is begins right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Bernard Beckwith follows up by saying, I believe that you're great, that there's something magnificent about you. Regardless of what has happened to you in your life, regardless of how young or old you think you might be, the moment you begin to think properly, this something that's within you, this power within you that's greater than the world, it will begin to emerge. It will take over your life. It will feed you. It will clothe you. It will guide you, protect you, direct you, and sustain your very existence if you let it. Now that, he says, is what I know for sure.
Hmm. So what is that power he's talking about, do you think?
A lot of people have tried to name it. I tend to call it spiritual energy, but even that sounds too limiting. I believe that all of existence, all of spirit, all of what moves in the universe, all of it is directly associated with what we can call an energy. We all come from this energy. This is where the origins come from. What's the origin of life? It all comes from this energy, and we are part of that energy. Some people call that energy God. Some people just call it source energy. Now, there are different labels for it, but that's what we all originate in. And I think that's ultimately what we're talking about here. We're talking about the manifestations of that energy. What do you think?
Oh, I agree, and it's always available to us. It's just, are we tuning into it?
Tuning into it and putting it to work, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of us, so are we putting what's part of us to work for us?
And he's suggesting that once we become consciously aware of our connection with source energy and what that feels like, then all these wonderful things will start manifesting for us.
Right. He's making a promise. I mean, he makes it pretty directly, pretty baldly, really.
Yeah.
He says, the moment you begin to think properly, this something that's within you, this power within you that's greater than the world, it will begin to emerge. And that's exciting all by itself. It will take over your life. It will feed you, clothe you, guide you, protect you, direct you, sustain your very existence if you let it. And that's the key four words right there. If you let it. You have to let it. You have to be willing to do it. You have to be willing to let it through.
And believe in it so much. Like, even on a different level, I was reading some information about some of the people like Walt Disney and Hanna-Barbera. Remember Hanna-Barbera Studios?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, there was a guy, Hanna and Barbera, and they just had these visions of what they wanted. They didn't even know for sure how it was even going to happen or fully what it was going to look like. And they just had this strong vision and idea, and look what happened.
Mm-hmm. Really, that's what any venture is. And it doesn't have to be a money-making venture or a business venture. It can be any kind of venture. Because a venture is essentially a road to where you're going. That's really to venture forth. Isn't that what venture means? To venture forth is to go off on your road.
And it all just starts with an idea.
It does. And it gets fed by ideas. And as you stay with it.
You don't have to know how it's actually going to happen immediately.
That's right. Because as you stay with it, more and more ideas get fed back to you by source based on what you've been thinking about. So it becomes a self-perpetuating process, which is really cool.
Yes.
and when we're able and willing to convince ourselves to stick to it, so to speak, to stay with this idea that things are going to work out, that serendipities will happen, that all kinds of things that we aren't expecting will happen, just by focusing on what we like, just on focusing on what we love, just on focusing on what we feel good about. When you start realizing that these things actually do happen through your experience, you start noticing them slowly at first, but you start noticing them and they start to happen. You begin to realize that no matter what path you decide to take in life, it becomes a magical journey. It becomes fascinating because it's not like mapping your life out is going to make it all predetermined. On the contrary, what it's going to do is it's going to open up stuff that you couldn't even possibly imagine were going to happen. So like you said, Walt Disney had no idea that his desire to make animations was going to turn into what it turned into.
No, and there were so many times where someone else was just thrown in the towel because something didn't go a certain way or whatever. But he just stuck with it and kept going.
And he had such a high belief. He and his brother Roy, the two of them were just, you know, they were driven to do this, even though they were there were so many signals they got along the way not to do it. You know, give up on this. This is a pipe dream. It's a fool's errand and so on and so forth. And they had investors who would cut them off at the knees. They had all kinds of, you know, obstacles thrown in their way. And they just kept right on going because they just believed in it. They believed in their crazy little dream of Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
And it paid off handsomely. I mean, wow.
Well, the legacy they left in the world. That not only did it pay off in that way, it's just proof that it manifested for them.
It did manifest. And they left a legacy that was just boundless. I mean, there is not hardly a country in the world that doesn't know who Walt Disney is.
That's right.
I mean, you may find people who don't like Disney for various reasons, but everybody knows who he is, and they know him for who he is for stuff that was actually good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. Mm-hmm. That's an important point, by the way. Just because you focus on good stuff doesn't mean everybody's going to like you.
But we all want everyone to like us.
But that's not necessarily what's going to happen. It's one of the things we have to remember as we're doing this stuff, as we're following our own bliss. Just because it's your bliss doesn't mean it's somebody else's. And what's great is we live in a universe in which that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
In which everybody can follow their own bliss, and it doesn't have to be the same bliss. In fact, it almost never is the same.
Right. And there's plenty of resources where everybody can enjoy.
That's right.
There's not a limit of like, oh, only so much money or only so much this or only so much that.
I can't remember who I read it first, but a number of gurus have said life is intended to be abundant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that too. I've heard that before.
Yeah. And it's one of those challenging phrases. It's one of those phrases you hear for the first time and you say, well. But it's really true. Life is intended to be abundant. And in fact, when we each chose to be in this life, we did so with the idea of achieving a life of abundance.
Abundance and joy and happiness, all of that wonderful stuff.
Absolutely. So it's amazing. We often have shows where, you know, we say, whoa, where did the time go? This is one of those shows where we've hit on all these great things, but it doesn't take long to say them all, so we're only 3/4 of the way through. Isn't it different how that works out? When you're on a journey that's got lots of bends and windings and turns and all that kind of stuff, especially if it's a conversational journey, it just flies. But when it's all just positives, and that's what we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes, it's like time just kind of stops. Or speeds up, depending on your point of view. I don't know which. But
yes. What is the next quote in the book?
Well, the next quote is Ralph Waldo Emerson. He says, "The secret is the answer to all that has been, all that is, and all that will ever be."
Interesting. Meaning vibration or meaning attraction, or what do you think he means by that?
Well, I don't think he meant vibration per se, because I don't remember anything from his writings that talked about vibration. There may be something there. I just don't really remember it. But I think that his idea of the secret was probably fairly close to what Rhonda Byrne was exploring and trying to express. And that he was trying to say that what we now call the law of attraction governs everything.
Mm-hmm.
It directly impacts every aspect of every life, in every time, throughout history and into the future.
Yeah.
All that ever has been, all that is, all that ever will be.
Yes. Yes.
Which, by the way, has a very definite correlation to Christian dogma.
Mm-hmm.
One of their key phrases is, I'll probably get it wrong because it's been a long time since I've been to a Christian church and been indoctrinated by the liturgy and so forth. As it was, let's see, how does the phrase go? I can't remember it now. As it was, it will always be something like that. World without end.
That had kind of a similar.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact phrase. There are Christians, I'm sure, listening who would know what that phrase is. But it's basically the same concept. And that concept is a concept of pure continuity. No beginning, no end, continuous.
Yes, yes, and even even when you pass on, a lot of people in the spiritual awareness always say to be continued, because it's just your body that's dying, so to speak, but your spirit continues.
I finally remembered the Christian phrase.
As
it was in the beginning, it is and ever shall be, world without end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, same concept.
Same idea, yeah.
Same idea. And it's a reassuring one, because it means that we can never get it wrong.
Get what wrong?
Any of it.
What's it?
Anything that we do in our lives, anything that happens in our lives, we can screw up royally, and it doesn't matter in the sense that we can turn it around anytime we want to.
That's right. That's why Esther Hicks always says, we never get it wrong, and we never get it done.
That's right. Same concept. We never get it wrong, we never get it done.
Because there's always once we get something done, then something else pops up in our mind that we want to get done. And then something else pops up that we want to get done.
Which is a good way to let go of the whole idea of deadlines. Oh my God, I got to get it done.
But what does she mean by we never get it wrong?
I think that she means that you never get it to the point where you can't unravel and turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you never get it wrong because you're just a thought away from turning it around to a better way.
Yeah. I mean, literally, if focusing on negativity all the time is the equivalent of a 2-year-old covering his eyes and saying, you can't see me, if that's the equivalent of, if you want to call it this, cutting yourself off from the source energy so that you feel miserable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the idea of getting it wrong is that you would have to stay locked in that state for some reason, which it isn't the case. Just as the child can remove his hands from his eyes anytime he wants to, and he can see the world again, regardless of whether he's deluding himself that by covering his eyes he can't be seen, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
What matters is he's not locked into that condition.
And I also think it's a relief to know that we never get it done. It's kind of like a relief, like, oh, okay. Because there's always something new we're going to want.
Well, sure. It's a way of taking the pressure off of ourselves. One of the things that probably kills more than anything else is stress.
I mean, that's for sure.
That's one thing the medical industry will agree with us on. Stress kills. Well, if you can take stress and stressors out of your life, you end up with a happier life and a healthier life and a longer life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's basic medical science saying that. It also happens to be true. It happens to fit what we know about the law of attraction, about the nature of spiritual energy and the nature of life.
Yes.
It just is true. So you can't get it wrong. How could you possibly get it wrong?
Right, and you can't get it done because I've experienced this too. Like you really, really want something, and then you get that something. And then, like, 2 days later, you're already like, oh, but now I really want that.
So it's essentially permission to let go of the stress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's just so interesting how there's always something else we want. We think we want this, and then we get this, and then before you know it, suddenly you want something else.
the want machine is endless.
Endless.
Yes, we actually, it's actually even possible, I believe, to maintain consciousness and not want something.
Mm-hmm.
Because we believe that the thing that we want is somehow going to enhance our joy, our happiness.
Yes, but it seems like there's just something natural. Like there's always something else to want. I don't necessarily even mean material things.
Just no.
A goal reached or whatever, or there's just always something else that you want once you get what you think you want.
And one of the hints that Abraham Hicks and others give us is that as each of us goes through our lives and goes through our wantings and goes through our paths and experiences what we experience and does what we do and all those things, we end up creating, in a sense, a record that becomes part of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it becomes part of our legacy, but it also becomes part of the overall spiritual existence. So it's easier to understand the concept, I think, when you talk about some sort of great advances that were made. So when Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, it became a major contribution to the spiritual energy flows understanding of itself. And it became a key piece in the library, so to speak. But it's not just the big advances. It's the little things, too. The littlest experiences all contribute to that fabric.
Yes. Yes.
So we're in essence, we are helping to build the fabric of existence. Just through what we experience. And
that's
the fact
right.
that we all experience different things means that we are contributing differently to the building of that fabric.
Yeah. I mean, I've experienced manifesting, quote, big things and smaller things. And it is true, like, at some point, your mind's onto the next thing.
Yes.
Like, it's not just like you're done just because you manifested the this or the that.
Because we never get it done.
We never get it done and we never get it wrong.
We never get it wrong either. That's right. So let's look at the secret summaries, and then we'll try the entire exploration of the secret to its conclusion for this immediate 10-part series anyway. First of the secret summaries, you get to fill the blackboard of your life with whatever you want. That's freeing. That really frees a lot of people because we come into the life and we are taught by so many different sources that we owe, you know, various adults doing certain things for them and living life in a certain way. And and their idea of, you know, well, God is going to create your purpose in life for you, or he's already done it or whatever. And and we basically poison ourselves with, you know, all these teachings that get passed along. Well, guess what? They're not true. You get to fill the blackboard of your life with whatever you want.
That's right.
You are tied down to what somebody else thinks your life should be about.
No, no.
And in fact, interesting point, and I don't remember where I heard this from. It may have been Abraham Hicks, but I'm not sure. One of the key ways of understanding what it is when somebody else wants you to live a certain way or do certain things or behave a certain way is to understand that they are trying to impose those rules on you because they think it will benefit themselves.
Interesting.
So anytime some authority figure is telling you, you better live my way or else, what they're really saying is, if you don't live my way, I can't be happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, of course, is a lie. And when you see it that way and you say it that way, the lie becomes obvious. So I encourage everyone to be, in this sense, rebels against authority.
Yes, that's right.
Question authority at all times. Because you will end up happier as a result. And the interesting thing, too, is that the people who issue these dictations, these dictums, usually aren't living happy lives. Have you ever noticed that? The worst dictators in the world have miserable lives.
Miserable. Yep.
Absolutely miserable. And if you ever doubt that.
You kind of have to be in that space to demand other people live how you think they should.
Yes. Yeah.
Now that I think about it. Yeah.
Look at the way the characters who do that kind of thing in sort of a miserly way. Look at the way they get depicted in the entertainment world. Look at It's a Wonderful Life, Frank Capra's famous movie. And you've got the really bad guy, you know, the banker who wants to take over the whole town. Potter, Mr. Potter, the wealthiest man in town. He's also the most miserable man in town. And he's miserable because he can't get everybody to basically give all the rents to him so he'll have total control over the town. And even then, he's still not happy. Nothing can ever be done to make him happy.
There are some people like that.
Yeah.
There are in general.
Yeah. You look at any situation in life and you find them. They can be bosses. They can be political leaders. Oh, political leaders. What was the last time you saw a happy politician? Don't strain yourself now.
Not that I can recall.
I mean, we've seen politicians who put on a happy face, who try to look like they're happy all the time. They're smiling all the time.
Yeah, but you can always tell.
It's fake.
Like,
it's a fake smile.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. it's the wolf smile. Yeah, I'm laughing. Boy, are you in trouble. There is no such thing as a happy politician. It's actually a contradiction in terms, because a politician is somebody who is pursuing politics, and politics is about dividing the people for the purpose of creating factions to encourage one faction to win at the expense of the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which at best is a no-win proposition, but it's actually a lose-lose.
Well, right, and they're all very based, strongly based in I am right, you're wrong.
Yes. Yes. And I was one of those people. For the longest time, I was an I'm right, you're wrong person. Until I finally realized.
Well, you're not anymore. Yeah.
Until I finally realized that ultimately the only person I was controlling with this you're wrong thing was me.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of people, not just politicians, a lot of people have that need where, that they have to be right.
Oh, yeah. Which is a curse, by the way.
Oh, totally. I think Esther always says, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, that's pretty much what the choice is, because focusing on being right will definitely promise you to not be happy. And I can tell people from personal experience it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. I've known people that had that where they, you know, they had to be right. And it was, they'll go down trying to prove that their way is right. It's just like, oh my goodness.
I was in a group that was probably more addicted to being right than most, although I think all political groups are addicted to being right. But this group is
probably
particularly addicted to it. This is the libertarian group, because I still have libertarian beliefs and tendencies. But
right.
Libertarians are so addicted to it. And the most amazing part about it is, and it took me a while to realize this, libertarians are actually, for the most part, not all, there's a tiny percentage who doesn't fit this generalization, but most, I would say 99%, are incapable of expressing what it is they want politically.
Really?
As,
but I thought they know what they want.
As a positive.
No?
As a positive statement.
Oh.
They know how to
oh,
express
I see.
It as a negative statement. They can tell you all the things they don't want. And they're really good at telling you that part. But but I've tried this with some libertarians I know. I have challenge them. Can you express your beliefs without expressing something in terms of what you don't like?
Interesting.
And you get blank looks because they aren't used to thinking that way.
Mm-hmm.
It really shakes people up. And a lot of them will realize, you know what, there's some truth to what you're saying. I don't know quite what it all adds up to, but there's some truth in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is encouraging. I'm glad. But yeah, it's so easy to get hung up on being right. So if you find that you're a person who has a need to be right, your first best thing to do for yourself would be to try to lose that tendency as soon as possible. Because it's not serving you. It's working against you. And in fact, that's what I finally realized. I didn't make the connection at first, but around the time that I first discovered the secret, I had this belief that there were these secret forces working against my life because so many things were going wrong. I didn't realize that the secret forces were me and that and that they were directly drawn from my belief that I had to be right about things.
Right, like where was your focus?
Yeah.
Yes.
But that's what happens. When you focus on having to be right, you set yourself up for misery. And it's not worth it, folks. Trust me.
No.
So, anyway. Let's get back to the list here because there's some other really good summaries that we have time for.
Oh, okay. I know we have a few more minutes.
We have about a minute, so I don't think we have time to go through a whole bunch of them. I think what I'll say at this point is it's been great doing this whole series on The Secret. I don't know what our next topic is going to be. We're going to have to pick one, although you had an interesting idea, David.
Yeah, I was thinking there's some wonderful Esther Hicks books that we could certainly go through and find some wonderful information and things to talk about, for sure.
Maybe we pick up Asking Is Given.
Yes, that's a great one.
Let's go for that one, then.
Okay, that
David,
sounds good.
It's been a pleasure as usual.
Absolutely.
We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.